So welcome everyone and thank you for coming tonight. And as most of you know, that we always begin before we commence with the formal teachings. We always give an opportunity for anyone to ask any questions about specifics of the practices of meditation, the mindfulness that we've done tonight. But also I know many of you read and are engaged to one degree or another in the transformation of your lives and trying to apply to the best of your ability the teachings and the practices of Buddhism or other spiritual paths into your life to make significant change possible. And that is not always readily understandable or not always successful, the first attempts. And some things really kind of befuddle us. And we often feel stuck. And so sometimes it's good to have the opportunity to ask questions in terms of the application, the applied aspect of the practice, and to get some feedback. So if anyone has any questions about the practices of mindfulness, of Buddha Dharma, and its application to the reality of the situations you face in your life, personal life, interpersonal, work, societal, please feel free to ask any question you want. So when you think to yourself, if you have anything, you look at your life, and somewhere there isn't peace and harmony, that's a good place to begin. So the question is, when you sit down to meditate, is it... I'm just doing this for the recorder, Alex has trained me up. There's one, just set the intention to be diligent and energetic in one's practice, or is there also, one should also be intentional about what one is practicing? I would say it's both of that, and it could be even more. In this practice, there are many things we're seeking to transform. From the bigger picture to the smallest picture, the macro to the micro, we could say. And so, one of the larger contexts in which those of us who practice more formally within the Buddhist tradition, especially the Bodhisattva Mahayana, what's called. Kind of the way of seeking the path of enlightenment, seeking the path of transformation, is to when one is doing a practice such as a meditation practice or other types of practice related that one does, let's say, to be aware of one's broader intention of practice. Why am I practicing? Am I practicing to enlighten, to become more enlightened? Am I practicing to become of greater benefit to others? Am I practicing to develop the capacity to have greater skill and ability to be of help to others? So there is a context in which we are practicing, in which we are undertaking this specific practice, let's say, of mindfulness meditation, which really kind of keys into the broader purpose or the deeper purpose of our life or our spiritual life, which is really should be, over time, more and more just our life. But again, for many of us, that type of broader intention is not 100% manifest in everything we do. It's something we need to cultivate. Because we have lots of habit energy, things of pull us this and that, lots of other kinds of needs and wants and agendas. And so if we really are seeking a transformation to kind of bring that intention more forward in our mind, especially when we're undertaking a practice such as meditation, is good to do. To sit down with the thought I'm undertaking this practice so I can be of benefit to others. so I can help my own personal transformation and also developing my capacity to be there for others. You know, sets one kind of intention. And then, of course, to do sort of what we did today, to take a moment so we don't just sit down with our worldly mind and our worldly concerns and our duties and responsibilities, et cetera, et cetera, but to really take a moment to get clear. That's why you see, I mean, that's why sort of those of you who come regularly know that I more or less every week when I do the guided meditation, I'm trying to show you how to be doing it at home, to take a moment to really just relax, to get in touch with your intention, to kind of let go of the drama of the day, of the week, of the life, and really kind of feel a shift that you're entering a kind of a time where you're stepping back from the everyday concerns in mind, because you want to cultivate something deeper, something wider, something vaster, but also you want to take the time to use the meditation period to really renew yourself, right? Refresh yourself. And so that often means we have to kind of shake off the dust, the so-called dust of the world that is accumulated for us to enter that. And then again, I think it's very important to be clear, to really state to ourselves, this mind is a crazy mind, you know, it's very untrained, monkey mind, it's all over the place. You know, you sit down with an intention, I'm going to do this, I'm going to focus on such and such, and a minute later you're off and running, right? I mean, it's like, that's why it's called monkey mind, you know, monkey see, monkey do. You know, the capacity to kind of, it's almost like, you know, if you have a child that you're working with, or if you have an animal that you're trying to train, repetition is often as necessary. You know, that you keep guiding, and so this mind of ours needs to be guided, and you know, we're the guide, and so to kind of make sure that our, you know, I'm sitting down. This is my practice. You know, I am practicing awareness of the breath. I am practicing watching my mind. I am practicing counting my breath. I mean, there's lots of practices in meditation that one could be doing. But to clearly state, you know, this is what I am practicing, and also to do what you also hear me do, which is to really clarify in your mind that when thoughts arise, and how do you know the thoughts are going to arise? Because they do arise, and they always arise. And it's because in our daily life we often follow them, we know that that will be our habit energy. So taking the time to really state to yourself, you know, not only am I going to be focusing on full awareness on the breath or watching my mind, but that if I get caught up in any thought form from the most, a thought that I just think is the most credibly wonderful thought, insightful thought that any human being has ever had, so I'm going to pursue this one, or else I'm having the most terrible thought and I'm just disgusted with myself and I can't believe at this stage of my life that I'd still be having these kind of terrible thoughts. You know, whichever way the mind plays it, we want to be saying to ourselves, whatever thought arises, I'm going to let it go. Right? And if I find myself caught up in a thought, as soon as I can be aware that I've been caught up, I will let it go. And this, I can't tell you how often, this is the key piece here, right? You know, the practice of mindfulness, reveals to us things, but it is the process of what's called smriti, or this process of recollection, right? I know where I want to, you know, part of knowing where I want to go is also knowing that I'm not going where I want to go. Is that clear? I mean, and that's important, you know, because if I know what where I want to go, but when I go off it, you know, I'm lost. I just wander, you know, I'll just follow whatever road I get on until the end of time. That's not good practice. You know what I mean? I want to know where I want to go. I want to know when I've gotten off the road. And I want to remind myself, oh, I want to be on this road, let me get back on. Can you see how important that is? Until you get to the point that you have such, you know, good concentration, that's not so longer problematic. And part of that because of this monkey mind, is that we have to be very, you know, it is a puppy, it is a monkey, it is a child, right? It's out of control. It doesn't listen well. It has a short attention span, right? And so you know, if you're dealing with a child that has a short attention span, you have to be repeating often, right? And so, so the practice is not only to be focused on where you want to be focused, but you want to anticipate that thoughts will arrive and your habit energy will take you away, but that you are going to do your best as soon as you become aware of it to drop it, right? You know, people often say, I know I should drop it, right? I know I shouldn't be pursuing this line of thought or this obsession. Well, why don't we do it? Well, it's because we that muscle, see, it's like a muscle. That letting go muscle has not been exercised. So when we come to use it, it's very weak. So we find that the attraction of our thoughts, even if they're miserable thoughts, even if they're thoughts that cause us misery, or get us angry, or get us upset, or get us sad, or, you know, do all those kinds of things, you know, why do we continue to pursue it, right? I mean, people often say to me, I know better, you know, I know better, but yet I still do it. Well, obviously the truth is what? We don't know better, right? And it's going to take us time to know better, because we have to admit that we are still seduced, attracted, by thought, right? And there's certain types of thought, even though they are miserable thoughts, or even though they are just pure fantasies, and we know in our more rational moments they are doing no good for us, right? We are still very addicted to them, right? And so that capacity to say to yourself, I will not only do my best to focus on my practice, but I will be energetic in noting when I do get distracted, right? And I make a commitment, no matter how wonderful the thought is, no matter how juicy it is, you know, I will let it go, right? And that's, for many people, that feels uncomfortable, because you are used to what? Always completing it. Always running with it right till we hit the brick wall, right? You know, I mean, you know, we keep running with it so the full misery is extracted, you know, and only when the, you know, there's no more misery left, then are we finally willing to go on to something else, right? So we want, you know, so again. The meditation concentration muscle is something we are cultivating, but that capacity to see when we're going off and to train the mind that when we say, what? Let go, right? With our children, with our grandchildren, with our animals, right? We want them, when we say, let go, put it down, to what? To do it. It's a simple command that we have expectations that animals and children with very underdeveloped minds will respond to. So how can we expect less of our own minds? Right? When we tell it, drop it, we would like it to have the capacity to just drop it. Right? It sounds so simple, and yet we know the habit energy is very strong. So that's why when I say to people, I'm not just saying to make you feel good. When I say to people, look, if you have to catch your mind every minute, if you're meditating for 30 minutes and 30 times, you have to say to your mind, let go, and you let go and relax, and you come back to your breath, you're practicing mindfulness. You're practicing, you're meditating in a good way. You are watching your mind as it is. You are learning to deal with it, to attend to it, to tame it a bit, to train it to be responsive to your commands. Right? That's all mind training, which is that mind cultivation in the broader sense is very much what we're doing here. And so the ability to learn to concentrate, the ability to learn to let go, to learn the ability to have a mind that is responsive to your commands, to kind of have a mindfulness that kind of sees that the thought or story you're involved in is either not productive or it actually has a negative effect on your mind, or, you know, and to be able to see it, recognize it, and change. This is the greater context of our practice. Don't be narrow, you know, in your practice, right? You are practicing, let's say, mindfulness of the breath, but in that you are learning many things. You're learning about your mind, and you're learning how to act and interact with your mind. So those kinds of skills and abilities you can then generalize, right, to your life. And that's why we call this engaged Buddhism. We want it to be practices that not that we just develop a capacity for on the cushion in the meditation hall, but that we take the learning into our lives, because that's where it counts. Right? I mean, we don't want just want to, you know, if we only learn to be calm, happy people, creating value in our life, you know, when we're in these very isolated situations, but are unable to bring it into our daily life, our family life, our relationships, our work, it really has very little benefit to us. So we want to me, formal meditation, our weekly meditations, retreats, days of mindfulness, you know, these are sort of like, for those of you who, you know, ever spent any time, well, we all, I guess, did, high school and junior high, spent some time in the laboratory doing experiments, you know. You know, when we do experiments, they're under controlled conditions, right? But we know that if the experiment is meaningful, we want to be able to replicate it, right, in real life. And so the experiments that we are doing here with our mind in developing our capacities and of mindfulness, concentration, of learning to develop some capacity to know our minds and to tame our minds and to control our minds to one extent or another, we want to then be able to take into, to replicate, right, to make use of in our daily life. Any other questions about practice and practice in daily life? Please don't be shy. Yes. So that's one of those brief daily life questions you'd like me to answer. Sounds like that's a Dharma talk in and of itself. But let me I'll just say a few words. So the question is for the recorder is a question about sort of reincarnation that seems to be traditionally part of the Buddhist teachings. And does that imply that this is an evolutionary process in which sort of every lifetime there are specific lessons to be learned, and somehow life is just one big classroom and each of us have our own lessons, and the goal is to finally get it, that we don't have to keep coming back to class and we can graduate and you know, hooky forever or something. Right, recess forever. First, let me talk about reincarnation, or actually rebirth. What you will find, of course, in Buddhism, which comes from Asia, is that you find very much belief in rebirth. Using the term rebirth rather than reincarnation, is very prevalent. Now, again, that is, please understand, that is not a core teaching of the Buddha. I mean, that he taught, okay? But yet, I would say, because he grew up in a society where that was just an accepted belief, the same way we could say that that it's traditionally in a Judeo-Christian or Christian culture, where that's the dominant religion, idea that people, after they die, go to heaven. You know, there is that kind of rebirth, is just widely accepted. People may have all different ideas about what that is, but in the same way we could say that rebirth or reincarnation, the sense of that there is a continuation, that our presence in this life, in a body, is a conditioned existence. It is conditioned by birth, growth, decay, and eventual death. But there is something beyond that, something that we are, that each of us are, that is beyond that, that continues on in some form. But I just want to say that when the Buddha was asked questions about that, he very clearly didn't get into it, which is interesting. Because he was primarily concerned with what's going on in the here and now. So you know his very famous response to people who would ask him, can you tell me, you know, who I was in past lives? And we know, you know, there are a lot of people who are interested in who they were in their past lives, right? I mean, past life, people want past life regressions, or they go to channelers, or different people are interested in who they were. And the Buddha would say about that, he said, you know, if you want to know who you were in your past life and what your past lives were about, he said, look at your life condition now. Because right now you are kind of reaping, or you are the summation, you are the effect of all your past causes, right? So he said, in a certain way, if you have a blissful life where everything is working for you and you have total ease and everything is wonderful, you can imagine that you had good things going on in your past life. You made good causes. You know, if on the opposite there's lots of suffering and difficulty, and no matter what you do, there's always conflict, you can imagine that your past was difficult too, right? So, I mean, that's sort of the way it's interesting what he left it. And the same way when people say, oh, you know, Buddha, you must have the capacity to see into the future, tell me what I'm going to be in my future lives. Again, he would say, you know, how you will be in your future is the effect of the causes you're making now. Right? If you want to see what your future is going to be, how your future is going to be, see the condition of your life now and the causes you're making in your life right now. So that's, in a certain way, the way he would respond, because we get a sense he was not in a culture that the Indian culture of the time and probably till today, which is very enjoys lots of metaphysical speculation and philosophical speculation, religious speculation, he wasn't, we could say, into that, right? So while he didn't ever deny it, you know what I'm saying, he just really didn't get into it, as seeing, you know, the main thing is how you are living now. The actions of your body, the actions of your speech, the actions of your mind, this is what it's about. And this is where you should be focused. Now, obviously, if one does believe, right, in a continuation of some form, and again, rebirth, reincarnation, they do, whether, you know, I mean, Buddhism doesn't believe in a soul, so it doesn't believe there's some sort of entity that sort of continues on, but it has its own way of looking at that. I mean, obviously, if one has a sense of continuity over time, right, we could say, that certainly broadens things, right? It certainly broadens things. And it sort of, I would say, gives one a sense of the long term, we could say, right? I'm in this for the long term. But what is that long term? The long term, again, I know people talk this way, you know, nowadays about this is a classroom and we have lessons to learn. Some people even think there's some kind of something that's giving us the lessons to learn. Sort of like, before we take birth, some sort of entity or deity or something kind of says, Angie, your lesson in life is to go down, and, you know, sort of like those movies from the 40s or something. Actually, Buddhism doesn't do that. It really is about that what's propelling us, whether what's propelling us in this life or what's propelling us, if you believe, in past lives, are the actions of our own body, speech, and mind. Right? That's what's propelling us. It's called karma, right? The law of cause and effect. This is what is propelling us. right? It is propelling us in this lifetime, it's propelling us each and every day, and if you take the broader view of many lifetimes, that is the mechanism, and it is solely under our control. Knowing that, obviously we become very attentive to the actions of our body, speech, and mind, because we know that we have the capacity of setting forth causation that will create goodness, happiness, well-being for ourselves and others if we, you know, if we are concerned about our future. In a certain sense, the practice of Zen is very much a practice of living in the present moment and living in the here and now, but there's also a maturity and understanding that we have to be aware of the causes we're making in our life. Right? Actually, this is, if you study Buddhism and you learn about the Eightfold Path and things like right action and conduct, you know, the five mindfulness trainings that you know that we recite here and do here, that's all about kind of cleaning up our act, we could say, on the level of karma. That we really want to stop doing those kinds of actions, which clearly cause harm, conflict, suffering to ourself and others. We want to stop using this mouth of ours and our capacity to generate words, what's called speech. We want to stop using it as a vehicle for, again, creating conflict, creating harm, creating hurt, right? And we want it to become a vehicle that is constructive, that is positive, that is for the good. And then, of course, in meditation, we learn about our mind and our thoughts. And this also, we want to be, also enter into the process of transformation. You know, so as opposed to kind of this, I mean, I'm just trying to rephrase it. So instead of the classroom model with the lesson model, in Buddhism, it's really the movement is from ignorance to enlightenment. You know, if you're asking me, you know, what is this about? This is what it's about. You know, it's how do I move out of a life conditioned by self-centeredness, egocentricity, narrowness, constrictedness, emotional affliction, pettiness, dissatisfaction, you know, all of that, to a life of openness, a life of freedom, a life of understanding, compassion, right? That's the journey, Doug. That's the journey. Now, interesting enough, when you said about, you know, because the classroom model, especially people who didn't like school, you know, there's some people who love school, by the way. You know, they're on their 80th degree already. You know, they just right. So there are some people who love school, right? But there are many people who don't like school that much and do want to graduate and get out and never come back. It's interesting. In Buddhism, there are like two major ways of attending to that. One is called the way of the Arhat, and one is called the way of the Bodhisattva. Are people familiar with these terms? Anybody not? Yeah, that's fine. So, what's interesting is in the path of the Arhat again, which is A R H A T or A R A H T, Arhat, which sort of means, it's a Sanskrit word. It sort of means saint. We could say it's a saintly person. And the path of the Arhat, which is a valid path, is about an individual who just says that, you know. Yeah, it's a mess, this world, right? You know, the whole thing's a mess, and I want out, right? And my focus of life is to cut myself off from all those things that cause me suffering, cause difficulties, cause me to lose it, right? And I am just going to cultivate, right, my own enlightenment so I can get out of here. That's called the path of the Arhat. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, way oversimplifying. And so don't repeat anything I say. especially to people who follow the path of the Arhat. again, it's not considered like a selfish path. It's just considered, it's in Mahayana Buddhism, it's called the path of the Hinayana, the small vehicle, which means it's like a one-seater, right? That's all it means. Now, in the other ideal, which is called the Bodhisattva ideal, the awakened being, the awakened warrior, whatever you want to call it, is the vow not to leave the world of dukkha, the world of suffering, until everyone is out. Right? It's sort of like, you know, it's, I guess, a different, I mean, I don't know, well, this image came to me, it's sort of like, you know, you're in the burning house, right? And there's one person, you know, who just gets out. Right? First one out the door. And then there's a person who's helping everybody else get out and is often the last one out. And the Bodhisattva is that one. The Bodhisattva says, yeah, this is, you know, this is a lot of suffering and ignorance going on in this world, right? And I am going to follow a path of awakening, of enlightenment, but I will stay here to be of benefit, to help, as long as I'm needed. So in and that's called the Mahayana. Remember, the other is called the Hinayana, small. Maha means great. So this means it is the great vehicle. It's the bus. It's the, you know, there's like room. It's like, you know, it's not the one-seater plane. It's the jumbo jet. You know, it wants to go with everybody, right? Because it the difference is the first individual is just very focused on their own suffering and their own liberation. And again, that's not to be faulted, right? But the other person looks around and notices that everybody else is in the same boat, right? All my brothers and sisters, all my family, all my friends, everybody I work to, everybody, you know, in society, you know, they all want to be happy, and they don't know how to create it, and they go about it in ways that only creates more suffering. And if I have somehow good fortune stumbled upon a path and have been able through my own good fortune to come to a certain degree of liberation and understanding, you know, I want to help. Right? I want to help everyone. So in that case, there's no end to it, Doug. We don't want to get out. Right? Because also there's great meaning and joy in helping others. So all of a sudden the Bodhisattva discovers this very profound principle, which is not readily apparent to the individual. Because most of us, you know, the individual thinks, I got to work this out for myself, right? I'm alone and I got to work it out for myself. The Bodhisattva makes that wonderful discovery that wanting to help others and being with others is itself very liberating. You know, to be genuinely present to another human being, to be genuinely loving and open and kind and et cetera to another human being, is the path itself, is very liberating. Because it gets us out of our self-absorption. It gets us out of our narcissistic way of dealing with life. So it is a path of itself. And it just goes on, you know. So what is the path, lifetime after life, Brian? It's the path of enlightenment, right? And you might say, in answer to your question, probably for each of us, right? Each of us are unique. Each of us have our own issues. Each of us have our own karmic load in this life. And that if we are introspective and reflecting, hopefully we'll see what our issues are. I would imagine many people in this room, the type of people who come to meditation, are people who reflect in that way and are probably aware these are really these are the kind of issues that have really restricted me in this life, and they are different than the person sitting next to me, right? And so I think one can discover very clearly what it is that we need to liberate ourselves from this in this lifetime. But it's an endless process. It's an endless peeling away. And we have, how do we know that? Because we have the examples of enlightened teachers and Buddhas and whatever who show us what it means to live a life of total freedom, where one is not restrained at all. One is not constricted at all. One is not contaminated at all by issues. So for everyone here who says, wow, do I have issues? Can you imagine what your life would be if you had no issues? If you had no issues. Nothing in any direction that held you back. Nothing in any direction that constrained you. Nothing in any direction that in any way caused you any kind of emotional negativity or resistance. Can you imagine that kind of openness? That kind of empty, free mind? Well, that's an enlightened mind, right? And we all have that capacity. So you can see, it's a developmental process. And again, your question about many lives, I would say most of us could probably even see in this one life, right? One could look back over one's life, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and see, when I was in my 20s, 30s, these were the kind of issues that were most present to me. But now in my 40s or 50s, really those aren't the issues anymore. And now there are other issues that have become clear because maybe those have been resolved or whatever. So in that way, I think it just continues. But we always want, as people who are following to one degree or another a path that is seeking greater awakening, greater enlightenment, greater freedom, that we're always, moving in that direction. Because that direction will keep the light flowing. Does that? Any other questions? Good. So I wanted to, we've been dealing for several months now, for about 3 months, with the pith teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. And tonight I wanted to read from this book called The Teachings of the Buddha. It's an edited by Jack Kornfield. It's just one of these little anthologies. Everything's just a page here and a page there, paragraph here. And this is a little thing from text. It's an ancient Indian Buddhist text called the Buddha Karita by Ashva Ghosha, and it dealt with the life and the activities of a Buddha. And Ashva Ghosha, in this little adaptation, this is what he says, and then we'll comment on it. He says, the Dharma of the Buddha, and here Dharma, which has many meanings, here the Dharma means the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma of the Buddha. The Dharma of the Buddha does not require a person to go into homelessness or to resign from the world unless he or she feels called upon to do so. So again, just to set this in context, remember we came back to that, remember talking about the path of the Arhat? Well, often the path of the Arhat traditionally is associated with people who become monks and nuns or hermits. They're people who what? Who kind of leave the world. The world's a mess. Relationships, they only cause you suffering. Possessions, money, the whole deal is just a setup for suffering. So I'm just going to renounce it all. And, probably some of you from time to time have felt that way. So there's always been this path of people who go toward renouncing the world, the path of homelessness. And he says here, so he's obviously at a time in India where that was very much a common practice. he's saying here very uniquely, he says, to follow the Buddhist Dharma, one doesn't have to do that unless one is called upon, unless that's one's personal inclination. But, he says, the Dharma of the Buddha requires every person. So now he's going, which again is very true. It doesn't matter whether you're a monk or a nun or a layman or a lay person, whether you're married or unmarried, whether you have children or don't have children, or whatever your gender is, your sexual orientation is, whatever. Right? He says every person, right? It doesn't have to do with the actual circumstances of your life. The circumstances of your life is just how your life is manifesting. But the Dharma of the Buddha requires every person to free themselves from the illusion of self, to cleanse one's heart, to give up one's thirst for pleasure, and to lead a life of righteousness. So this is a good teaching for us, right? Because often we think, you know, if I could only change this and change that, geographical or job or, you know, a relation, you know, somehow then everything would be different. But what he says, it doesn't really matter wherever we are. I mean, what matters is wherever we are, right? Whatever the challenge of our life is, whatever the situation of our life is, whatever the context of our life is, wherever we find ourselves, right? These are, we have only some very basic requirements. The first is to free ourselves from the illusion of self. That's what's number one. Now again, like Doug's question, this is another Dharma talk in itself, and actually we're going to be having an intensive starting in October, which will be called the Deconstructing the Myth of Self. It'll be a 6-month intensive just dealing with that. But again, just very simple, in Buddhism, the real cause, the underlying cause of so much of our self-created suffering, dissatisfaction, is because we are so wedded, we are so attached, we are so deeply embedded in a belief that our self, that my selfhood is real, solid self-existence, as opposed to what? An illusion. Now please understand, if any of you have ever been in the presence of a good illusionist, you know, have anybody ever been to a good illusionist? What was that one? I remember we used to see David Copperfield. I remember going with my children, but it was quite wonderful, right? Because when you're with an illusionist, or if you're just on a sidewalk somewhere and you run into somebody who's very quick with their hands, right? A magician of sorts, you know that they're giving you the illusion that something's happening, right? That appears to be happening, doesn't it? There is an illusion that something is happening. But when we are in our logical, rational mind, we know what? It's a trick. It's a trick, right? She wasn't sawed in half, right? He couldn't. I remember once seeing David Copperfield where he's up in a cage, locked in a cage on a motorcycle, right? And all of a sudden he appears behind you on a motorcycle, you know, in the middle of the orchestra, right? And yet it certainly appeared like that just happened. So an illusion is something that has the appearance of being real, and yet upon investigation, it can be shown to be not. The self is like that. It feels real, it appears to be real, there seems to be something solid here, but upon investigation, it is not that way at all. And knowing that is very liberating. That's why it's the key delusion to be investigated in Buddhism, because the whole structure of our emotional life, the whole structure of our ego defense mechanisms, right? The whole structure of our needs and our wants and our ego needs and wants is all based on a belief in the intrinsic solidity of a self and that it's me. Right? So just very simply, he says, so every person needs to free themselves from this illusion. Now again, please don't go the extreme of thinking that somehow this means that the illusionary self does not have an illusionary existence. It does, right? So we can watch the magician, right? And we can enjoy the magician. And we can be amazed at the magician, right? And we can applaud the magician. And we can even give him some money, right? And yet we know what? It's a trick. The whole thing's a trick, right? So it is possible to be in the world of illusions, to enjoy the world of illusions, but not to be sucked into it. So the first one everybody's got to do is free themselves from the illusion of self to cleanse one's heart. So in a certain way we can say, and actually in Buddhism, traditionally, heart and mind are not separate, they're usually one character, heart-mind. But here, what's really being referred to is, we could say the cleansing of the illusion of self is kind of an insight, wisdom, seen into function. While the cleansing of the heart, we're talking about, we could say more the emotions, right? And we want to free the heart from its what? From its self-centeredness, from its total self-concern. So it can be a loving, warm, open, compassionate, friendly heart. A heart that is deeply interconnected with life, right? So we want to cleanse our hearts of all its contaminants. The same way when we bathe, we want to cleanse our body of the dirt. When we wash our clothes, we want to get the dirt off our clothes, right? In the same way, our hearts have become contaminated. They become dirty. And what is that dirt? It is all anger, hatred, judgment, jealousy, right? All those things, fear, anxiety, all those things. Right? We could go on and on. All those afflictions, we can say these are impurities that have grown and covered over our basic good heart. We all have good hearts. You all have good hearts, right? Does everybody know they have a good heart? Yeah. I think we know that because we see that under right circumstances, how naturally our goodness comes forward, right? We don't have to make it come forward. You know, I'm always delighted that when, you know, a child or a dog or something comes into a room, people just start lighting up. Now, why is that? Why is that? You know, it's just a natural thing. There's something about in the presence of the uncontaminated, right? Our uncontaminated heart comes forward. And I think, I truly believe that all beings have, their hearts are good. They just get wounded, they get contaminated along the way and wander away from that basic goodness. So every person has to free themselves from the illusion of self, cleanse one's heart, give up one's thirst for pleasure. Everybody like that one? We don't like that one. So the key operant phrase here, a word, is thirst, not pleasure. This is very important. We get, you know, and especially as lay people, because, you know, monks and nuns, they turn. You know, their lifestyle is to turn from pleasure. Because why? Because, you know, one can get addicted to pleasure. Right? So the key operating word here is one has to give up one's thirst. Right? When one is terribly thirsty, right, one is focused only on what? Getting something to drink. It dominates you, right? When you're thirsty. That's what he's getting at. If we are consumed, as many people are consumed in this world, you know, especially in our society, but in really all societies, I think it's just that our society is so sophisticated in creating avenues of pleasure, you know, instant pleasures, filling the refrigerator with pleasure, and endless pleasures, and endless little pleasures that in the short run appear to give pleasure. That if that is the purpose of our life, if that is what we are always thirsting for, we'll never get to where we want to go. That's really what it's about. It doesn't mean that one can't enjoy pleasures when they come one's way, right? Pleasures are what? Pleasurable. So, you know, when pleasure comes one's way, and lots of things are pleasurable in this life of all kinds, one can take one's pleasure. But it's not to make it the aim of one's life, the purpose of one's life. Why? Why not? Building attachment. Yeah, well, it builds attachment, but it's attaching to something that is not giving us what we aim for, which is a real happiness. See, pleasure, the problem with pleasure is what? Short-lived. It's short-lived. It takes place in conditioned, you know, the pleasure you get from ice cream only lasts a short amount of time. Right? If you put that spoon in your mouth, it can only give you pleasure for just a few seconds. Right? This is the great disappointment of people, that pleasures don't continue. Right? That pleasure doesn't continue. That all pleasures have their intensity in the moment when there's sense and sense context, but that diminishes. That is the nature of sense. You know, pleasure is sensory based. It is something that happens when the eyes perceive an object, when the ears perceive a sound, when the tongue perceives a taste, when the nose perceives an odor, when the skin perceives a sensation. Right? It is pleasure comes through contact of a sense organ with an object. When it makes contact, its initial hit is either pleasurable, unpleasurable, or neutral. But that only continues when it makes contact, and the intensity of that contact will begin to diminish, as we all know. Now, if you understand that, you can what? You can take the pleasure when it arises and it diminishes, it's fine. But if your thirst is always for pleasure, that's what you're living for, you have to then what? You're immediately driven to go find something else pleasurable, which again will immediately diminish, or very shortly diminish, depending on the kind of pleasure. So you're endlessly running after, thirsting after, and always getting pleasure, but then feeling the loss of pleasure, the flatness, the boredom, right? Which everybody feels. And you think there's something wrong with you, but there's nothing wrong with you. That's the nature of it. So when you understand that, you realize it's that grasping, it's that attaching, it's that going after, which is the problem. Right? I want to have a mind that's at ease. And if I'm going to thirst for something, let me thirst for liberation. Let me thirst for the freedom from suffering. Let me thirst to really be of benefit to others, because that is something that can continually give me a sense of well-being. Right? Again, we are human beings. We have senses. Right? When our eyes perceive something beautiful, we what? We enjoy it. Right? When our ears hear sounds, they are pleasurable. Same thing with all our senses. So it is good to have. To be open up to the richness of our sense life. In the, you know, in the verses in the Faith Mind, it says the sense world is the world of the Buddha. It's a very famous line in the verses on the Faith Mind. Right? The sense world is the world of the Buddha. The senses, this body is the body of the Buddha. It is the thirsting, it's the attachment of the mind to the objects that contaminates things, because it causes us suffering. Right? If I am living for pleasure when I either don't get the pleasure, how do I feel when I don't get the pleasure I want? Frustrated, angry, disappointed, right? All kinds of emotional afflictions. What happens when I get the pleasure? And now it's beginning to fade, I'm beginning to lose it, right? Again, ill at ease, frustrated, unhappy. And we don't realize that the reason we're feeling these things is because of the thirst and the attachment is now causing us to suffer. Is that clear? So this is why, again, the problem is not pleasure. The problem is how we relate to it. But the Dharma of the Buddha requires every person to free themselves from the illusion of self, to cleanse one's heart, to give up one's thirst for pleasure, and to lead a life of righteousness. Sounds very Old Testament, doesn't it? Those who were raised in Old Testament congregations. Righteousness. So again, please remember everything is translated. I'm not sure what the Pali or the Sanskrit word is that somebody is translating as righteousness. Actually, Samuel Beale is old time. The nice thing about Buddhist texts these days is the whole field of translation is much more sophisticated, much more better than it was 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. So Beale, I remember that name, early translation. So what can we say for leading a life of righteousness? You know, to me that means to lead a life where there's no regret. You know, no shame, no regret. That you're living a life that is congruent with your values, with your inner values. You know, you know what I mean? There's a rightness that I think each of us know. I think we know it both ways, right? I think when we are not acting, speaking, living from a place that's expressive of our intrinsic values of how we want to be in the world and how we want to relate to the world and how we relate to others. When that's not occurring, we know it. We may not be able to stop it. We may not be able to get out of it. But I think at some level we know if we take the time to stop that we, in a certain way, we are betraying ourselves. Because in this moment we are not living the truth. Not like the higher truth. Not like the truth from above. But I think the truth that really comes from our own true nature. And I think what he's saying here, lead a life where you are right with yourself. Right? Right with yourself. And many of us live lives where we're really wrong with ourselves. We're always selling ourselves short. Right? We're always kind of giving in to impulses and needs and agendas and programs that we really, for many of us, we know that doesn't serve us really right for where we really want to be in our life. And so I think he's saying, you know, be true to yourself. Be true to your values, right? Your inner values. And don't live from your petty self, from your ego self, from your selfish nature. Don't live always to please others or to because you're scared of what others are going to think of you. Right? Live your own righteousness. Is that, you know, that's what I think he's getting at. It's hard to put in words, but I think it's something that everybody knows. Right? We know, I think we know when we're there, and I think we know when we're not there. Right? And I would think if we had that kind of self-awareness, and we kind of worked with ourselves throughout the day, we know. We know when we're there and we know when we're not there. And again, the point of view of where he, it's interesting, he says, the Dharma of the Buddha requires. You know, when one, it's interesting, there is a ceremony, a small ceremony, that when people formally enter the Buddha's path, they go through. And in that ceremony, one is said that one is now entering the family of the Buddha. One is becoming part of the Buddha's family. And that one is, and in the ceremony there's a line that says, after the people have received, gone through the ceremony, say, you are now a student of the enlightened. I mean, that's interesting, right? It's very personal, right? It says to the person, you are now a student of the enlightened one. Live it. Live with that sense, right? That from the inside, that you have found a teacher and that you are his or her student. And from the inside, you're going to live that life. And what does he say that life is? Again, to free ourselves from the illusion of self, to cleanse one's heart, to give up one's thirst for pleasure, and to lead a life of righteousness. There is another paragraph which is also very interesting, but maybe I'll save that for 2 weeks. So let's, questions. I mean, free themselves from the illusion of self, cleanse one's heart, give up one's thirst for pleasure, lead a life of righteousness. Everybody, everybody signed on for the week? What do you think? Doable? Yeah, doable. Doable perfectly? No. But all of us, by just these four things, and just carrying them into our week, with some kind of self-awareness, right? To do my best in all situations to come out of living a life based on self-centeredness, self-cherishing. To really do one's best not to engage one's emotional life, one's heart life, in negative motions, but to really cultivate. At the same time that we're not cultivating the negative ones, we are cultivating altruistic ones, loving kindness, friendliness, patience, understanding. Right? To give up one's thirst for pleasure, and you'll see it. You'll see where the mind is starting to move in a certain direction. It wants something. It feels like it needs something, right? A lot of people do that with what? Food. A lot of people do that with other kinds of activities, surfing the internet. You know, there's all kinds of things. And again, it's not that these things are bad. I'm saying just watch your mind, you know, as it kind of tells you what. Yeah, I gotta have it. I need some pleasure, right? I need a pleasurable taste. I need a pleasurable sensation. Now, why does it? Where's that need coming from? And is it really going to satisfy the itch you have? You know, are we willing to stop and look at our dissatisfaction? Look at our boredom? Look at our staleness? Look at our whatever? You know, and to really be attentive to what's going on. And lead a life of righteousness. That's a piece of cake. So any questions about these four? So just do your best. That's all we can do. So we'll stop here.